The Iranian president repeats calls for guarantees from the West to revive the JCPOA. He lived just around from New York to take part in the UN General Assembly meeting. U.S. Central Command says the military's Green Village base in northeast Syria has come under rocket attack. China reacting to the U.S. president's latest comments on Taiwan, saying it will take all necessary measures in response to activities that split the nation. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iranian president saying that he will use his visit to the U.S. For the UN General Assembly to openly defend the rights of the nation and highlights acts of aggression against it. Ibrahim Raisi also stressed no meetings with American officials will take place during the visit. This is the first time that Raisi will be attending the UN annual gathering. Earlier this week, he told CBS News that Iran cannot trust the U.S. with what he called meaningless promises on the nuclear deal. Raisi said that Iran is serious about reviving the 2015 agreement. He noted, however, that this will hinge on Washington offering relevant guarantees not to follow suit on the former president's path to withdraw from the accord. Okay, now from Brussels, let's bring in Elijah Magny, who's a journalist and political analyst, and see what Elijah thinks, and let's ask Elijah his thoughts about this opportunity that the Iranian president is going to use to speak about the Iranian nation's rights and, in his words, defend their rights.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure.
First of all, there were visits in previous years of Iranian president to the United Nations General Assembly under the invitation of the UN to speak their mind and to state what are the problems that their countries are facing, particularly the U.S. illegal sanctions, and also open the door to other leaders around the world to meet President Raisi and to discuss the main issue, and in this case, the nuclear deal, keeping in mind that Iran has no intention to meet Iranian U.S. officials.
Unfortunately, we don't have a good connection with Elijah. We'll try to get hold of him at a later time. Now, moving on, Iran reacting to the border clashes that erupted between Armenia and the Azerbaijan Republic last week. Tehran urges the two sides to settle their disputes through dialogue. Foreign Ministry spokesman says the two countries should show political will for talks and use regional frameworks to put an end to the tensions. Nasser Kanani says that Tehran is ready to help a diplomatic process. The spokesman is also stressing Iran's opposition to any change to geographical boundaries in the region. Deadly clashes flared in several border areas between Azerbaijan and Armenia last week before a fragile truce hold it on Tuesday. Tensions are rooted in a border corridor that Baku is planning through southern Armenia to an Azerbaijani enclave. Yerevan Haver says that the corridor is against the terms of the 2020 truce that ended the bloody Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. A U.S. military base in Syria has come under rocket attack hours after unconfirmed reports of a similar strike on another installation housing American forces. Central Command says it's investigating the latest attack that hit the Green Village base in the northeast. It claims the rockets failed to hit any U.S. force or equipment. An attack on the same base last month injured one U.S. military personnel. The U.S. military has refused to withdraw from Syria, even after the country won the war against Daesh terrorists. Washington deploys around 900 troopers in an oil-rich area in eastern Syria. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, has provided us with more details regarding the recent rocket attack on the U.S. base in Syria.
According to local sources, eyewitnesses, and some various media outlets, there has been an attack on a U.S. occupation base in Deir ez-Zor countryside. That base positioned or situated inside Al-Umar oil field. This is one of the largest Syrian oil fields in that area, And also, this is one of the largest U.S. bases of occupation inside Syria. Now, this is not the first time this particular base is targeted. What happened, according to eyewitnesses, was that sounds of explosions were heard over there. Smoke was seen. Also, ambulance vehicles were heard rushing to the area. And some U.S. helicopters were on some reconnaissance following. Important to say that there is no claim of responsibility over who is behind this attack, but this is not the first one. In the past month, such attacks increased on various U.S. forces of occupation locations in that area of Syria.
Okay, I was just talking to Elijah Magnier, who's a journalist and political analyst in Brussels. Elijah was telling us about the Iranian president's visit. He's going to attend the UN General Assembly meeting there. We had a bad connection, unfortunately. Sorry for that, Elijah. Go ahead.
The importance of this visit, it comes just a few days after the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, where the representative of half of the world were in one room, and Iran had become an official part of the organization that calls also to end the U.S. unilateralism over the world. And President Raisi is in a position today to criticize again the U.S. unilateral and illegal sanctions on the Iranian population, which is the right of Iran to live in dignity without being under the harsh sanctions imposed by the U.S. It also offers another opportunity for other leaders to come close to President Raisi in person and talk about the most important nuclear deal, particularly the time when Europe is under heavy stress for its own sanctions imposed on Russia due to the shortage of gas and oil, and Iran can provide Europe with the lacking share of gas that is no longer coming from Russia, and particularly the oil, mainly when Europe had decided to stop the import on the 1st of December. So it is an opportunity for Iran to slam the U.S. sanctions again, and also to show to the world that it's possible to survive without the U.S. hegemony, even with very harsh U.S. sanctions.
You know that on the sideline of the General Assembly, world leaders also get the chance to meet each other. And the foreign ministry spokesman was asked by reporters this morning, a few hours ago, if there was going to be a meeting. And President Raisi said that this is useless to have talks with his U.S. counterpart. Let us know a number of reasons why Iran is rejecting this meeting and finds it to be unfruitful.
For a simple reason, it's because the U.S. and the EU also are unreliable partners, because they withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. The U.S. declared that officially, and the EU did nothing to abide by its agreement. Secondly, the Americans would like to register small victories by posing and then taking photographs and pretending that nothing is happening, when they are failing to offer guarantee to Iran that any other president is not going to withdraw again from the JCPOA, and the current president in the remaining midterm is not going to come back and impose further sanctions under different excuses. So there is no point for Iran to accept and meet President Joe Biden when Iran refused to have the U.S. flag in the room of the negotiation in Vienna and refused any direct contact with the Americans as long as the Americans do not respect the JCPOA. If they want to meet President Raisi, they return to the JCPOA, they show they are reliable partners, which they are not so far, and then direct meetings can happen.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst in Brussels. The Taliban's foreign minister says that the group has completed a prisoner swap with the U.S. in Kabul airport. Foreign Minister Amir Khan Muttaqi says the Taliban handed over a Navy veteran to the U.S. 2 years after he was detained in Afghanistan. Muttaqi says that the key Taliban associate held by the U.S. for 17 years was released in return. Washington, the Taliban held several rounds of meetings before the group took over Afghanistan last year. Release of prisoners of both sides was a key component of the talks. The Taliban took power in August 2021 after the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan 2 decades into its occupation of the country. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is calling for intensification of what it calls all-out resistance against Israel in response to its expansionist policies. Spokesman Fawzi Barhoum slammed Israel for the seizure of large parts of land in rural areas of the occupied West Bank. He said this is another crime against Palestinians and represents expropriation of their property. Barhoum added that Israel will never succeed in ending Palestinians' legitimate fight for freedom by forcing them out of their lands. Tel Aviv has recently sped up its settlement construction on Palestinian lands despite international outcry. All of those settlements are illegal under international law. In the meantime, Palestinian schools in the occupied Al-Quds will observe a day-long strike on Monday in protest at Israel's attempts to impose distorted textbooks. The Palestinian National Islamic Forces, that's a coalition of political factions, has called for the strike. It says it's aimed at reaffirming the right of the Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not the distorted one. The group also called on international institutions to press the Tel Aviv regime not to interfere in the affairs of Palestinian schools. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods against Israel's attempts to prevent schools from teaching the official Palestinian textbooks. They decried Israel's disregard of their rights and chanted slogans such as No to the Distorted Curriculum, No to Judaizing Education. The Palestinians say that the regime is trying to deny students their right to learn their own history and culture. The U.S. president claims that the pandemic is over, even as the coronavirus is killing hundreds of Americans every day.
Mr. President, first Detroit auto show in 3 years.
Yeah.
Is the pandemic over?
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. And so I think it's changing, and I think this is a perfect example of it.
The comments were made as Biden himself contracted the COVID twice over the past months. He also asked Congress for more than $22 billion in funding to tackle a potential new wave of the pandemic in fall. The U.S. is already reeling from the virus, with Centers for Disease Control and Prevention putting the daily death toll at around 400. Now, Beijing deploring comments by U.S. President Biden that forces will defend Taiwan in case of what he called a Chinese invasion of the island. The Chinese foreign ministry says that the country firmly opposes Washington's stance and has lodged solemn representations with the U.S. The ministry says that Beijing reserves the right to take all necessary measures in response to separatist activities. China considers Taiwan part of its territory. It's been locked in tensions with the U.S. over that issue. The tensions have soared over visits by the U.S. House of Speaker and other American lawmakers to Taiwan in August. China has conducted several large-scale military drills around the island following the visits. The United States is heaping the pressure on Russia on all fronts, from economic sanctions to diplomatic restrictions. But the White House has gone a step further by telling South Africa not to associate with Russia at all. The South African president has hit back, saying it's not for Washington to decide who his country can or cannot do business with. The move may further alienate the United States when it comes to Africa as a whole.
On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. He has said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they've been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia. Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain?
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
News on Europe's energy crisis just keeps getting worse. The negative news is so many that it has become difficult to gauge just how bad the European energy crisis really is. But there's no denying it. Europe has been hit the hardest, having the highest increase in energy prices, some of the highest inflation rates, and the biggest risk of recessions. Hi, I'm Kaveh Tafwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, first, the unprecedented shutoff. Russia shutting down Nord Stream 1. That is sure to hit energy crisis in Europe. Also, Hungary, the Slovak Republic, and Czech Republic, 40% shortages in their GDP to drop around 0.6% at least. Then, EU's rocky future. Full gas storage, not enough for the EU to weather it out. You have social crises that are is showing its faces, along with social unrest. How bad is it going to get? 70,000 protested in Prague, one example. Then the West fight back plans, in particular Europe. The G7 price cap on Russian oil, that failed. Europe is outbidding the rest of the world when it comes to natural gas. Will that work?
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, concerns are rising in Europe about potential violent protests, astronomical economic losses, and the possible closures of hundreds of small businesses and factories. Russia has shut down gas flows to Germany since a few days ago. The decision has increased already high gas prices and energy prices, putting further strain on Europe's energy and utility companies. Sweden says it will provide liquidity guarantees to Nordic and Baltic energy companies worth billions of dollars. Italy is also feeling the strain of record energy prices, prompting the government to announce a plan to turn down the heating in homes and businesses as part of efforts to reduce energy consumption in the winter. Britain has been dealing with soaring gas prices and a subsequent inflation.
We'll get spades in the ground to make sure people are not facing unaffordable energy bills. And we will also make sure that we are building hospitals, schools, roads and broadband. Secondly, I will deal hands-on with the energy crisis caused by Putin's war. I will take action this week to deal with energy bills and to secure our future energy supply.
When it comes to online posts on the issue of energy and the crisis that Europe is experiencing, of course, this is all in the context of the Ukraine conflict. There's a transformation that has taken place. I don't know if you've checked it out, but when this conflict started, it was a lot of anti-Russia sentiment and viewpoints against Russia, almost to the max. But now things are turning, the tide is turning, and a lot of the focus is going on to the officials in Europe and whether they should continue down this path, as you're about to find out in some of the online posts that we're going to review for you. First, the liquidity crunch has already hit some major European electricity firms, which have been pushed to bankruptcy. We took a look further into this. The electricity sector is facing a perfect storm, with sky-high gas prices hitting the margins of European power companies at a time when more than 100 billion euros in investments are needed annually to drive the green transition, according to the industry. Next up, we're about to experience a sovereign debt crisis caused by the European energy crisis, all a capstone on the 100-year fiat experiment. Here's how I think the next 6 to 8 months go down. The next online post, we are not facing an energy crisis in Europe. We're facing a crisis of leadership. Next, if only Zelensky had implemented the Minsk agreement, no one would have died. Donbas would have remained as an autonomous region within Ukraine. Mariupol and Kherson would have been in Ukraine, and Europe would not have had an energy crisis. No U.S. inflation, and the oil price would roughly hover around $70 a barrel. And then comes the viewer comment of the week. Ha ha ha, the EU nations have to survive irrespective of what they show to the world. If they don't care and secure their own nation's interests, then they are doomed. Forget Ukraine, they are anyway on a path of destroying themselves by being America's proxy. There will be a time soon many EU nations like Germany will openly reject support at the cost of their own citizens. Notice the difference? Not too many anti-Russia sentiments in some of these online posts, reflective of many of what people are posting online. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this section of the Q&A. Joining us first is Kieran Allen. He's an associate professor at the School of Sociology. Kieran Allen, welcome to Economic Divide. Russia shutting down Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline to Europe. These are just some headlines. Full gas storage, not enough for the EU to last to the winter. Sweden announcing emergency guarantees for energy companies, facing the prospect of a war winter, and the cost of UK's winter triples. The headlines couldn't be worse, and the future couldn't look bleaker for Europe. Or,
well, obviously the future is looking bleak for the people of Ukraine. I think that Putin's invasion was totally wrong. I think that NATO have used it to try to essentially extend their sphere of influence. They've put in massive supply of armaments, which I'm totally opposed to. And the effect of all this in terms of the people of Europe, particularly the stupid sanctions policy, which, as you know, in Iran, only hurts the people generally. That policy is hurting working people in particular in Europe, the poor in Europe. I don't think it's doing any particular damage to Mr. Putin. I think that he's able to use the sanctions to condemn the anti-war movement that was growing in Russia. So I think the sanctions have been quite useless, and I'm certainly opposed to sanctions. But in answer to your question, is it bleak for the people of Europe? The answer is yes. What does that mean in practice for people? Well, I see the headline this morning in Ireland is that people will have to pay an extra 3,000 euros in their bills, and that's going to lead to huge social suffering.
Okay. By the way, the description that he used was the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine. That is up for question based on the viewpoints, but that is our guest viewpoint. Okay, let me introduce Mick Wallace now. Mick Wallace is a member of the European Parliament. Very appropriate for him to come and present his views on this program. Mick Wallace, thanks for joining Economic Divide. Europe is dealing with high energy prices. That has resulted in inflation as a consequence and many other things. How do you think people are going to be able to deal with this cost of living crisis, in particular, for example, like in the UK? Are we looking at how social protests will become a norm and this social incohesion that's going to happen as a result?
Well, I mean, already there is some unrest in England, in particular in Britain, over this. Britain is expected to have inflation close to 18% before the year is over. And if inflation goes to 18%, and if the increases in benefits and state wages is only at 3%, the working people of Britain could see a deficit of 15%, a 15% cut to their incoming pay. And meanwhile, the costs that they have to bear in order to make ends meet in their households is increasing by the day.
Now for our Infinews section of the program, where we review economic news from around the world. Our first item is a case of whether it's a wrong destination or not. Now, why do we question that? Because Ukrainian grain, which is the topic, is actually going to the EU instead of Africa. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the West of deceiving poor nations with this grain deal. So there you go, a case of equality going out the door when it comes to the EU. Next up, a topic that has been suggested and probably will go through from the new UK Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and that has to cover the issue of fracking and a fracking ban, that is, which Britain is now intent to remove. This move is viewed as a way to alleviate the energy crisis. Okay, but what about fracking itself? Well, it is extremely hazardous to the environment, and that is something that Liz Truss and her team need to actually consider if and when they go through with that. Next item, looking at another angle to the trade war between the U.S. and China, and it is about a chip war, a possible one. China's great leap forward in chips is facing a U.S. pushback. Beijing efforts to secure dominance over critical chips are facing resistance from Washington. And finally, a topic that has been ongoing for quite some time, toxic pollution. The Niger Delta oil spills bring poverty. They bring low crop yields to the farmers as a result. And this has been going on for six decades of oil exploration, which have made the Niger Delta one of the most polluted places on Earth, damaging a lot, including farmlands.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section of the program. Europe's energy crisis is not going anywhere. Perhaps it is one of the most difficult challenges that Europe is facing in its history, and people are suffering as a result of this. This is our breakdown in this in-depth section on the different dynamics that's involved. First, we start out this in-depth section with a simple question. How much of Europe's energy comes from gas? Well, here is the breakdown. Different sources of energy that Europe derives its energy uses for. We're looking at gas, oil, coal, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, and other. And as it is evident from the percentage breakdown, 34% is the highest out of all the other forms of energy. That comes from gas. How important gas is for Europe when it comes to its energy. Next up, we ask the question, which European countries depend on the Russian gas the most? Some of them is probably very alarming, like North Macedonia, coming in at 100% total reliance on Russian gas. Then we're looking at Germany, of note, which came in at 49% for its dependency, Italy at 46%, and France coming in at 24%. Of course, these percentages are varied based on the usage that we used here was from the year 2020 to the year 2021. Next up, let's take a look at countries which Gazprom has cut off supplies to. Now, this is important because it's showing a trend, more European resistance, then more countries may fall into this list. Resistance, i.e., not paying in rubles, which Russia has demanded. Poland, Netherlands, Bulgaria, Finland, Denmark, and Germany. Again, of note, Germany being one that we repeat in our breakdowns because Germany is a European powerhouse, but maybe not for long. So they have not complied with the ruble payment system that Russia has asked for. Now, the next piece of stat is very alarming because it shows the European gas storage. Now, we've broken it down from previous years and then all the way up to mid-June in the current calendar year. In the year 2019, you had 67% filled for the gas storage. Then 2020 at 77%, 2021 at 43%, and the current year, 52%. Now, that's best case scenario, which has probably gone down because it's not being replenished. So that is a case for alarm, because when you start dipping below the halfway line, then that is something that, with no gas coming in, how could you then fill up the capacity for your emergency storage? Now, the 43% also was of note. Why? Because, well, 43% was lower when it came into the year, into the current year. Now, how will Europe deal with the way that it's coming up short on energy? And we took a look at gasoline in this case. Now, its plan to reduce reliance on oil, it's really unbelievable, some of the steps that they have taken. And for example, now we took all the steps that was recommended by the EU. Reduce speed limits on highways, that's one of them. Work from home up to 3 days. Car-free Sundays in cities. Alternate car access to roads in cities. And from the millions of barrels used, which is about 45 million, when you do all those things, if they are done or executed, you're going to save a few million barrels of oil, maybe 4 million barrels of oil per day, which is a lot, but the big question is, how are they going to be able to do that? That is what is illogical based on what many are saying. Okay, let's get some analysis into this. Rejoining us is Kieran Allen, Associate Professor at the School of Sociology. Kieran Allen, welcome back. The energy crisis, so vast, it has affected all of Europe. Worse yet, we're looking at how it has affected the world. And GDP of certain countries obviously are diving. When you take a look at what the European leaders are doing, not only to their economies, but to their people, what do you think? And supposedly this being led by the U.S., I say supposedly because many don't believe that that is actually the case. We're also looking at conflicts that the U.S. wants to push against China, which is looming on the horizon.
Well, it is a dangerous threat. You're absolutely right there. Will leaders in Europe realize this? I have my doubts. I think that what we have is a growing inter-imperialist conflict between America, which assumes that it is leading the European Union, and the Russia-China axis. That's what's happening. Do I think the European leaders are going to retreat from their policy of imposing sanctions and isolating Russia? No, I don't. We had a recent meeting of NATO where China has now been defined effectively as a a strategic competitor, a threat to NATO countries for the first time. They've described it as that. So do I actually think that European leaders are going to pull back? No, I don't. Do I think the people of Europe, through people power, which is always the way change happens, can begin to rise up against their leaders? Well, I hope so. And I think that starts on the economic level of people standing up, fighting against inflation, whether it's in Europe, Russia, America, you name it. People have to stand up against their leaders.
Okay, standing up against the leaders. People power, as he said. Let's see what Mick Wallace thinks, member of the European Parliament who rejoins us. Mick Wallace, this energy crisis obviously is very vast. You are at the European Parliament, and I'm sure you have so many debates going on as to how to handle it. But in particular, when we take a look at the European leaders, they are beginning to look like the ones who are going to be blamed for this, because this is just being taken out, it seems like, for the long term. People are getting aggravated. The economies of the countries are being hit, and you still have a looming conflict that's coming up with China. How do you think this is going to end up?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the energy crisis, I mean, don't forget that energy companies are making bigger profits than they ever made. So they are taking advantage of the current situation. We're looking at a crazy scenario now where the EU's efforts to punish Russia is backfiring. Just how are they ever going to see common sense? Right now, we have a big problem in Europe, in the European Union in particular. We don't have strong leaders. And I would also say that the leadership of the big member state governments is also leaving a lot to be desired. But you ask me, is Europe going to cop onto itself start behaving in a more independent fashion and look after the people of Europe rather than being subservient to US empire? Sadly, with the present regime in Europe, with the likes of von der Leyen, Michel, and Borrell at Foreign Affairs, I'm sorry to say that it's hard to be optimistic that these people are going to bring any change.
The measures and rising energy prices, as well as out-of-control inflation, has caused anger and discontent across the continent. People in Germany have brought back Cold War-era Monday protests amid the cost of living crisis. And in the Czech Republic, tens of thousands of people held a massive protest in Prague, accusing the government of paying more attention to the war-ravaged Ukraine than to its own citizens.
When it comes to Russia, special military operation, plenty has been covered about the ramifications of this on the world economy, the European economies in particular. But did you ever stop to think how the U.S. benefits from this conflict? Well, we will do that for you now. First, there is the issue of U.S. natural gas exports to Europe. Russia's natural gas exports to the EU in 2021 was about 200 billion cubic meters. That equates to 81% of its total exports. Due to Ukraine conflict, Russian gas exports to Europe will be reduced by 72.6 billion cubic meters annually, a conservative figure. Enter the U.S. U.S. natural gas can fill that gap. With production capacity set to exceed 1 trillion cubic meters, the U.S. is in dire need of buyers and can fill that gap. And here it is. Energy traders are making a killing exporting U.S. natural gas to Europe as prices soar, with some single shipments bringing in $200 million. The U.S. is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. One expert said, "You're not talking about a margin, you're talking about a multiplier. All in all, it's insane." So that covers the gas issue. Then comes the dollar. The value of the dollar has strengthened, especially against the euro. The reason why the dollar will be strengthened is that overall, Europe is no longer considered safe due to the conflict in Ukraine. For example, after the 2014 Ukraine crisis, the broad nominal exchange rate index for the dollar against major currencies rose 8.7% from February to December 2014. Number three on the list is the gains that the US will have from the disruption caused between Russia and EU when it comes to trade. As EU sanctions continue to ratchet up sanctions against Russia, bilateral trade will shrink significantly between the two. And it's the EU that suffers. Russia
EU trade in 2021 was roughly around $282 billion. Yet by comparison, Russia-US trade in 2021 stood at $34.4 billion. And finally, there will be substantial profits for the US military-industrial complex. Every week, sometimes more than once in a single week, more military aid is pledged to Ukraine. It was in May when the US House passed the bill approving $40 billion more in Ukraine aid. So much is the aid that the total, roughly $53 billion over 2 months, goes beyond what President Biden requested and is poised to amount to the largest foreign aid package to move through Congress in at least 2 decades. So there you have it. This is what's called war profiteering. That does it for my segment of the program.
The way to describe the European energy crisis is getting close to actually calling it an Armageddon. Now, in case you didn't know, the actual definition is pretty appropriate, and there's a surprise in it, and I'll tell you why. The site or time of a final and conclusive battle between the forces of good and evil. That's right, the question that comes about now is which forces are good and which forces are evil, especially when it comes to the U.S., for example. Is the U.S. the force of good when it's leading Europe down a path of economic destruction? Or is Russia the force of good or evil, standing up to U.S. and NATO's aggression? Think about that. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. We always appreciate any comments or questions. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are talking about the human being from the perspective of the Quran and perspective of Islam. We're trying to understand ourselves before anything else. If I know myself, then I know my Lord by the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And Allah says in the Quran, Allah made them forget themselves because they forgot Allah. So we need to have a self-discovery in order for us to maintain the rights of one another. Now, human beings rebellious against constraints. That's just a headline. Although human beings are unable to completely break off the relationship with our past, be it the social, or be it the environment, or be it history, or be it the way we were born, these things we mentioned in a previous episode, mind you. We may revolt against these constraints and achieve freedom from their domination. We are able to bring about some kind of change in these areas through wisdom and knowledge on one hand, and our willpower and faith on the other hand. And we can adjust them to our own desires as to control the reins of our fate. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He created me in a way, and I have, you know, inherited certain things in terms of looks, in terms of history, in terms of social factors, in terms of geographical factors, which were imposed on me by my parents and where they were living. But can I rebel against that? Can I change certain things? And the question is yes. There are certain things I can change. Being, for example, in terms of heredity, when a person is born with certain color, a certain type, now with modern technology, with knowledge, people can change the way they look in terms of their color of their eyes, their noses. They can do many things. They even can change the color of their skin now, right? Yeah, so there's a bit of freedom there. In terms of, for example, the social aspects, I was born in a certain environment. I can change that environment completely, go to a different environment. I can adopt a different religion. I can adopt a different faith. So also, I have a bit of flexibility there. In terms of my history, for example, I can completely let that go and start my own and never mention where I came from and how... To whom should, you know, to whom do I go back? I can cut ties with my past and start a new page in a new place where no one will know me, and I never tell nothing about it, to my kids about it, and it will be a fresh slate. So there are flexibilities in this regard. We can control them as we desire. But obviously, it has to be done through, as far as Muslims are concerned, has to be done through what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala deems to be accurate and deems to be visible and applicable. I can't go doing things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has did not allow me to do in terms of when it comes to my body, in terms of when it comes to my faith, in terms of when it comes to my, at least even my history. You know, I say, well, I don't care about Islam and the Islamic history, it does not concern me. No, obviously, there are still... As a Muslim, these things will carry on. You can have a bit of flexibility, but there are things are forced upon me. Let's take a short break, and then we will come back right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. Now, when it comes to our to human beings, when it comes to the matter of being predestined as a human being. So when it comes to free will, we understood that we have flexibility in certain things, and in certain things we have no flexibility. Although by many that predestination is the primary factor which imposes limitation on a human being's freedom, we do not believe this in Islamic, though. In Islam, we do not believe in predestination. There are two questions that may arise. Does predestination exist at all? I mean, are human beings, are we forced to do these things? Is there such a thing? Does it confine a human being? Does it limit the human being if it does exist? And the brief answer is that predestination definitely exists as a reality, but it does not restrict the freedom of a human being. How so? Predestination carries two separate concepts. The first being the divine concept in disputable decree regarding the creation of events and phenomena. and the second being the measure of them, right? As we say, qada and qadar, right? According to theology, it is quite certain that the divine decree does not befall any event directly and without an intermediate, right? It is any single event through this relevant cause, it demands a cause and effect, okay? That's a type of organization of the world in which man acquires freedom on the basis of his wisdom and free will, and at the same time confronts limitations which are imposed on him by hereditary, historical, and environment factors that we've mentioned before. We then see that predestination is not a limited factor, but all kinds of limitations which appear to man under the divine decree initiates from the above causes, which is the, you know, historical, social, and hereditary. This is the true of man's freedom, as well as the divine decree necessitates man to pose wisdom and free will, and to be able to release himself on a larger scale from submission to social environmental constraints and to manage his destiny. Human beings, yes, when it comes to predestination, there is predestination in nature. We moving towards one path. We going from this world to the next world. That's a form of predestination itself. But how I choose to go on about myself in this reality that I'm living in, which is the decree of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is my choice. I have the free will to either submit to Allah or not submit to Allah. I have the free will to submit myself to the social environment that I'm in, the social environment constraints, or I can break from them. I have an ability to do so. So does predestination exist? Yes, in definite answer, as a reality, it does exist. But when it comes to the freedom of human being, we can move. Does it confine me? No, it doesn't. So even that predestination, which is the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created this world, but me and you, we still have the ability, we still have the capacity to change it to our advantage and to shape our own future. Inshallah, we will continue this discussion, this topic, in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.